Oh, I'm all ready.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Addiction 911 show. We are very excited today to have Ginger. Now, Ginger, you're going to have to help me with the pronunciation of your last name. Birkelhammer, is that correct?
Okay. Oh, I'm amazed. You got it.
Birkelhammer, great, great. Ginger's been sober, wow, since May 22nd, 2000, and is internally grateful to the hundreds of people that were put in her path that have helped her along the way. When she got sober, she had no hope, no future, and no self-confidence. One day at a time, she built a life that she's now proud of. At some point in recovery, Ginger wanted more. She started to explore what was her life's purpose. She loved working with alcoholics and drug addicts to see the light turn on in their eyes. Ginger has sponsored many people through the recovery process and beyond. She was introduced to the concept of life coaching, and it was a perfect match. Ginger's life purpose is to give back to the recovery community, helping people find their life purpose, and in doing so, will have a fulfilled life that they can be proud of. There is an incredible life to be had once your feet are fully planted in recovery. Alcoholics and addicts have spent so much of their life squandering hours in the addiction and now have a choice on how to spend their second chance they were given. Ginger lives in Warren, Vermont, home to Sugarbush Ski Resort, with her husband and two golden retrievers. Their daughter is a junior at the University of Vermont studying animal science. Well, welcome, Ginger. We're so thrilled to have you here today.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
And you are such an incredible inspiration to so many people out there who are struggling right now with addiction. So, you know, can you tell us a little bit about that 2000? That's, you know, a long time ago. And tell us a little bit about, you know, how you finally, you know, dealt with the life of addiction and winded up staying clean.
Okay. Well, yeah. So, you know, it was a long road of addiction. I was pretty much in it for 26 years or so. From a very young age. And I, you know, in the end, I kept thinking that things that I would add to my life, like I thought I wanted the husband and that would fix me, the house, the kid, all these things I kept acquiring. And it didn't help with my use. I kept using despite having all these things. In fact, my addiction took off every time I got that dream job, or I really thought I wanted a baby and I had a baby, and that was not the answer to what I needed. And in fact, it added to my misery. And what I, you know, in the end, I was just in my kitchen drinking, using drugs, attending to that baby, you know, and she was four when I got sober, and I would send her off to daycare, maybe spend a half hour a day with her. And, you know, I just hated myself. And it was so lonely, even though I had acquired all these things, I was so lonely. And it just was a vicious cycle of feeling my feelings and then using. So I didn't have to feel them. And in the end, I just really wanted to die. And I had a very dramatic kind of ending, but I'll spare you all those details. And I wound up going to a 12-step group that saved my life. And I didn't know. I didn't know about the disease until I was educated about it. I just thought, oh, I'm a nice girl who likes to party too much. And I just didn't know. And that's one of the things, is to be educated about our disease.
Yes.
Yeah, that's so important. I mean, you know, it's interesting for people who have never struggled with addiction. You know, there's a lot of stigma around addiction, and getting inside the head of somebody who, you know, is an addict, what would you like to explain to people who just don't understand, who, you know, have the stigma against people who are, you know, who are addicted?
There's, you know, there's so much. It's separating the person from a disease, and all feel sorry for somebody with cancer, all feel sorry for somebody who has to, you know, has diabetes, but the person that has this addiction does not have a choice. If they're truly in the addiction, there's no choice but to use, because it's a itch that you just can't fully scratch. and you don't want to do it, but you have to do it anyway. So it's a disease of a mind, and it's a disease of the body.
So it's not
And
like a compulsion almost. It's a compulsive act that.
absolutely, absolutely. And it's for the person who's in it, the addict, it's torture. It's absolute torture because you know you don't want to do it. You know you have everything to live for. You know you're killing yourself, yet you do it anyway.
Right. And that's what's so hard, right, Debbie, for people to understand. I mean, as people who like maybe your husband, your daughter, your family, people who are surrounded around you probably had, anger issues with you. Like, why can't you just stop? Stop doing this. You're selfish. This is how we feel, but we can't understand it.
Right,
Yeah.
absolutely.
If you relate it to something like you said, like a compulsion, like an obsessive compulsive disorder or mental illness where you compulsively have to act, and that's what it sounds like, it feels like. Inside of the addict itself, feeling that you don't want to do this, but something's just forcing you to do it.
And you know what, Ginger? I step back from my speaker. I think I'm too close. I'm a codependency coach, so I work with the families of the addicts. And I love what you said about separating the person from the disease, because when I start working with them, they are so full of resentment and anger and bitterness toward the addict, and they're the victim, see themselves as the victim of the addict. And to separate, this person is sick, this person has a disease, yet you don't love the disease, you love the person. Because I've always said, had a lot of family members, addicts, ex-husbands, siblings, and I said, addicts have beautiful hearts. They're loving people. They're just sick. And so many people think that they don't understand, if you're not an addict, why they just can't by willpower stop using.
Oof,
And
yeah.
if they really wanted to, so they feel like they're doing it on purpose. However, it's always a fine line too, because once they realize that you guys, that it is a disease, then, they can start having some compassion, but yet we don't want that compassion to move them into more caretaking and enabling. Like if you had someone in the house dying of cancer or something like that, you take care of them a little more than you do with an addict who's manipulating you to, enable them. So, yes, it is important, to understand the disease part of it, and that the person is sick, and being able to separate that person, and how do you handle the person when the disease is active, and when they're acting like that, it is the disease. It's not the real person, it is the disease.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's a crazy disease where it's probably the only disease where you can't go comfort, you can't go help somebody, you have to turn your back on them. That's what's so hard to, sorry, my dog's barking, to comprehend and are you, Ginger, when you recovered, did your family have to use tough love on you? Because we've interviewed a lot of people, and it seems like everybody who's been addicted said the same thing. I had to hit that rock bottom. That was the only way. And the families had to stop enabling. Is that true for you as well?
Absolutely. My situation was different. I mean, I have a very small family. I have a husband and one child, one daughter. And my husband has never used a drug a day in his life, and he's a normal drinker. So he just really didn't understand what I was doing and why I was doing it. So when I hit rock bottom, it wasn't they, he never really turned his back on me. He had a lot of compassion, which is, and I've often said to him, why did you stick around? And, Debbie, he said to me that I know that's not the real you. And so somehow he had something within him to understand the difference. I was a very sneaky alcoholic because my husband went to work at 6 in the morning and didn't come back till 7:30 at night. I had all day to use, and I kind of got it together at night. So I was different in that way.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So go ahead. I'm sorry.
A lot of hiding and not, so it's hard for him to see you actually when, you know, you were hiding it from him when you were actually really, really drunk or using, you were kind of sobering up to kind of not alert him or the family that this was going on.
Absolutely. It was, you know, what was more apparent was my depression, you know, and as you said, there's mental illness and, you know, who knows, you know, what I mean, if I had depression first or alcoholism and then depression, but that was more apparent was my depression and my wanting to kill myself. And so he definitely tried to rally around that, meaning he tried to say, oh, life, you know, trying to be positive. And I was just so in the negativity of it all. And in the end, you know, I was hospitalized for suicidal thoughts. And so I think that was my bottom, you know.
Yeah, that's your bottom.
Yeah. And that's another good point to bring out is one of the things I teach my clients, that the alcohol or the drugs are just a symptom of the real problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you remove the alcohol and you remove the drug and the person is fine. Like you said, you had a lot of, you know, depression and suicidal thoughts, and that's where the recovery comes in and the 12 steps come in. It's the junk on the inside and that you got to work on, you know. And something you said in the beginning, Ginger, about how you were using everything on the outside, you know, to fill that. And the name of my company is Inside Out Wellness because of that. The opposite, because even as codependents and addicts, we look for everything on the outside to feel good on the inside and to fix on the inside, you know, religion, sex, relationship, jobs, you know, babies, whatever that food, alcohol, you know, whatever it is, we were looking for that fix, that we're looking to get healed and become whole on the inside. And we think it's out there somewhere. And so it's not until you do that inside work does it start showing up on the outside and we start feeling better. So your bottom really was an emotional bottom.
Right? Very much so. Oh, very much so. I said I was spiritually bankrupt. And so that, you know, absolutely emotional. I had just, you know, in fact, the alcohol and the drugs stopped working. So maybe that's why I was able to pull off looking less like an addict, because I would be using all day and I wouldn't really be high. I would just be what I thought was normal or just fixing kind of an ache that I had. And that's part of my bottom is I was getting really angry that it wasn't working anymore.
Mm.
Now I'm really in trouble because I'm now feeling all my feelings and the what my substance used to do wasn't doing anymore.
Right.
And that's a real tough place to be in.
Oh, yeah.
And so, and you're right, the work started after I put all the substances down. And mind you, it was years that I was trying other substances, you know, emotional affairs, which, you know, some of the guys in the rooms were so, you know, the sharing of their emotions. And my husband is very unemotional and that's why it works. But look at these guys who can share feelings. And all of a sudden I'm in love. And so it's about understanding that nothing on the outside is going to fix me.
Right.
And I did a lot of work on the inside, and it wasn't just the 12 steps. It's, you know, it took a village of different types of work.
Yes. So on a spiritual, emotional level.
Yes, totally.
What would you say, Ginger, to someone who's watching this right now, who's in the middle of addiction? You know, they're right now, they're, you know, they're suffering and they don't know where to turn. If somebody's, you know, out there watching this, is going to watch the replay, what advice do you have for them?
I would say that, you know, you don't have to live like this anymore, that this could be the last day that you ever have to feel this way, that it takes one phone call to somebody. And, you know, and I would say most importantly, talk to somebody who it was in an active addiction because nobody else understands like we do. We do not, you know, I would talk to people and they would say, you know, for God's sakes, just stop using, you know, and I would say, you know, I guess you don't understand. And it was the one person that talked to me who had what I had. And I immediately wanted what she had. And so I did what she did. And so the person who's suffering, I work with a lot of moms and, you know, that were in my situation. And what do I do all day while the kids are at school then? You know, it's that huge, vast amount of time that is filled often. You know, there are a lot of lies that we tell ourselves that it's not so bad, that, you know, I'm managing. Look at me. I have a house and kids and cars and, you know, I'm doing okay. It's, you know, I'm not in the gutter, you know, in the Bowery of New York, you know, that's not the face of addiction. The face of addiction is the mom who's coping just to get through and, you know, a little disenchanted with the life that they have. And I would say it's just not worth it to think about all the money you're spending, all the lies you're telling to keep up the addiction. It is a huge amount off your shoulders if you just stop doing that and try to live honestly.
You know, you bring up a really good point about the lies. I stopped smoking. It'll be 19 years. I believe it's 19 years, right, since I had my last cigarette. And, you know, that is an addiction too, though. It's not really, you know, discussed as other addictions. And I used to wake up first thing in the morning, first thought was a cigarette. And when I tried to quit, I would like have so many times where I would lie to myself. Like I'd quit for a while. And then I would say, you know, I'm just going to be one of those smokers who drinks when they, you know, go out or has a cup of coffee. And then it was like, oh, I'm going to just smoke 5 cigarettes a day. And I finally realized, and what kept me, luckily, the reason I quit was I have 4 kids. Every time I was pregnant, I obviously didn't smoke. It made me so nauseous. I couldn't even if I wanted to. So with the last child, I just went, once I found out I was pregnant 6 weeks, I just never started again. But how I never started was, accepting that I was addicted to cigarettes, and I know I could never to this day pick up a cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the truth. If I am to pick up a cigarette, I will be doomed. So for 19 years, I will not even want one now. It makes me nauseous to look at them. But if I did, I would be back. So I think that's the thing too. When you're at this, what you were bringing up was so important. You're saying about the lies. If you're saying, you know what, I'm going to be a social drinker. That's what we hear a lot with alcoholics. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to be the kind on the weekends, or I'm going to be, you know, do this and that. No, you can't do that. You know, if you're an alcoholic, you can never have a drink again. That's just the reality. And yeah, I think the acceptance of that will really help you. Is that what's helped you stay clean all these years?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, as we said at the top of this, what I needed to understand was that I was suffering from a disease, that it wasn't a choice I was making. I am different than a normal drinker. My body metabolizes it differently. My mind tells me that I don't have a problem. And so, you know, until I really understand that I had a disease, and then here's how it's treatable. And so every day I get up and I say, and you know, after all these years, I don't take for granted that I could pick up a drink today. I just don't. I've seen it too many times. I've seen people, you know, with 15 years go to a meeting and then walk out and have a drink. And so I don't take it for granted that I've put 15 years together. What I remind myself every day is why I'm doing this, and that I remember those last few days of torture. You know, it wasn't even days. It was the last 4 years when I had to take care of a baby and manage my alcoholism. I just never want to go back to that torture of the lies and, you know, stealing from my husband's wallet and, you know, all that stuff. I just, it, and it perpetuates itself because you feel guilty that you've done these things. And so you just don't, you know, you just keep using because you don't want to feel. Every day I get up and I just am so grateful for the life I live. Now there's nothing different from the first day I walked in. I still have a husband. I have a car. I have a kid. I have a house. It's all the same, but I am a completely different person.
Wow. That's incredible.
And Ginger, I would like to talk for a minute about, because there may be some people on the show watching now or going to watch later that are wondering if they have an addiction problem. Mm-hmm. Because I know that people will say, people think that, well, if you're an alcoholic or a drug addict, that's someone who uses every day and is an everyday user. And yet we know from in recovery that you can be a binge alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
There's alcoholics that drink once a week or once a month.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's different types, or there's, you know, addicts that only use on the weekend, or, you know, and so they kind of stay in denial about, well, I'm not that bad because I don't use every day. So talk about that for a minute, about what maybe they're wondering, you know, kind of having a question, what clarifies, you know, what makes someone an alcoholic or an addict,
right?
Even if they're not using every day.
Well, it's interesting because I have a quick answer for that, because if you're wondering, you probably have a problem. It's,
right.
You know, the people who go about their day or week or whatever, and then, you know, they'll have a drink at the end of the week, you know, just to relax and, but they don't think about it. When even the person who has a drink once a month, but is thinking about it throughout the month, that could be alcoholism. Now, it really is, when I work with people, it's about your relationship to alcohol.
Right.
And we all have a different relationship. I had this romance with it. I had, I always had a case of wine, and because I could afford wonderful wines, how could I be an addict, you know? But it was all about the romance of it for me. And, sitting down with this beautiful glass and a bottle of wine and, how could I be alcoholic? Again, it was about thinking about it from the moment I got up, when I could do it. And so again, it's really about the person's relationship.
And I think too, it's a lot about how people, you know, because I know alcoholics who don't drink every day and all, but they've gotten in recovery, but they never were able to just have a couple glasses of wine or, you know, go and do a party and have three drinks or whatever. You know, once they started drinking, it's just downhill. You know, they just want to keep drinking. And then had some consequences of, you know, fights or missing work the next day, or, you know, things that are the questions that we ask, you know, has it made your life unmanageable in any way?
Right. And that's, you know, what, you know, and that's the second part of it. So, you know, what happens to you when you put it in your body?
Right.
And it sets off an allergy, as we call, you know, for lack of better terminology, it basically is, you know, you put it in your body and, you know, there's a sensation that's so wonderful. Now, we as alcoholics drink for that sensation. And if we could only keep it at that level, we'd be great. But what happens is, we, you know, have to have another. And before you know it, we do despicable things while we're drunk. And we don't mean to do it.
Right.
But there's also, you know, a lot of people that I've met are controlled drinkers. And they still have a problem because they would like not to control it. They would like to go at all out. And that's an issue too, you know, so yeah. You take it away and life gets better.
Yeah, and you know, the thing we're talking about alcohol now, and this is, I mean, I think a little different, and it's from, you know, a drug user because it's so socially acceptable and it's so ingrained in our lifestyles. You know, so when you don't drink, you know, if you have friends or just everybody socializes with alcohol, holidays, you go out, everybody has to drink. So you're the only one not drinking. I think it makes it almost more difficult. I mean, it's easier with certain things because you can't do them in public. You know, people can't do drugs in front of people and they're, you know, sit there and do it together. But alcohol is something that's part of our lives. And it seems like everybody's, you know, everybody's drinking. So how has that been for you over these last 15 years, you know, being the person and being among friends and family who are drinking? Like, how have you dealt with that?
And you know, and that's a great question. It definitely it's an individual thing. Some people can't go to parties. Now, I have, you know, I believe I'm safe because I do all the things that I need to do in that day to prepare myself to go to a party. Now, I did not go anywhere for the first year. And I remember going out on my 1 year anniversary with a bunch of sober friends. We went to a bar, not a bar, a restaurant, and with the bar, and I was so nervous. So in early recovery, it's, you know, you go with the intention, with the reason you're going. And that's what I always tell people. You're going to be with family. So ask, you know, be a part of the family, but leave early, come late, leave early, a lot of those things. For me now, I have no problem telling people I don't drink. And people often say, "Oh, well, good for you." And I often say, "No, good for you." Because, you know, I'm a mess when I drink. You know, and then I'm often, you know, and what's most interesting to me over the past 15 years of being around people who drink, everybody pretty much drinks normally. You know, there are very few people in my circles nowadays that are alcoholics. And if they are, if I come across somebody, I'm so happy to help them if they want help. So.
And give them the tips and stuff. And I think another thing probably that's helpful is, you know, when you're quitting any addiction, it's that replacing of something. Like if you're a smoker and you have a cup of coffee every time you have a cigarette, then you have that coffee, you're like lost. And same thing, if you go out to dinner and you're always having a glass of wine, you know, like I get migraine headaches. A lot of times I'm on, you know, medicine, Tylenol, whatever. So I can't have a glass of wine. But if I'm going out with somebody like Debbie or my, and it's one of those days I'm on a headache medicine, I love to have a club soda with lime. To me, that's my replacement, you know, and I enjoy a club soda with lime just as, you know, the days I, you know, don't drink, I don't drink that often because it's like a headache. So, you know, it's, you know, it still feels like you're kind of, you know, in with the people who are having wine or drinks, but you have something, you know, that's good. An alcoholic, I guess, could use that too. You know, they could get a wine glass with it with some club soda and still feel part of socializing.
I would never suggest that because what happens is for, you
An
know,
alcoholic.
if you're truly an alcoholic, what you have to do is change everything about you. And what you do, you know, again, our problem is in our mind. So all these things we tell ourselves, we have to unlearn certain things. So, you know, this whole idea of the non-alcoholic beer is nuts. That's nuts to me. And because it's, you know, you're still perpetuating a lifestyle and a lie about who you are. So I'm not that, you know, I don't have the same mind that I used to have when I was drinking. And so I have to change everything about me. I mean, so now I go out and it's about being of service to other people, finding out how other people are doing. And which is so weird because I used to go out and all I would talk about is my stupid stories and you know my dumb jokes and now I go out and I ask people how they're doing, and that's it's got to be a complete shift. in
so
who
what
you.
Happens though, like if you have, you know, people who are I'm not saying alcoholics, but say you're married to somebody who enjoys a glass of wine on the weekends, and do they have to stop doing that? I mean,
no.
Like, so how does the alcoholic deal with those people around them?
Again, it's so individual. In the beginning, absolutely, it was tough. But I had come to understand my disease. I had come to understand I lost my right to ever drink again. And, you know, I have had enough alcohol for, you know, all of New York. And, you know, and if I am convinced that the reason I am in such depression and my life is not where I wanted it to be because of alcohol, I don't want to make that choice anymore. So if I am convinced, then I must find a different way of thinking and of being in this world than the way I used to be. So, you know, a funny story is, we used to live in New York, and then, but we would come up in the winter on vacation to ski. My husband goes out to the store and he comes home with a six pack for the week, mind you. And, sits down, drinks his beer, and he looks at it and he says, "Ah, I bought non-alcoholic beer. Oh, well." And I said to him, if I was drinking, first of all, you'd get a case. Secondly, you would be back in the snow to get real alcohol, because alcohol is what I like. I like the way it made me feel. Right. Now I got to find other things to make me feel differently. And that's being of service to people, of helping others, of being the wife that he deserves, being the mother that my daughter deserves. And that's what keeps me sober.
So replace, what you're saying is replace something else, because you knew this alcohol or this drug is what made you feel good. You need to actually replace that with another activity unrelated completely to that makes you feel good, you
right.
know, whether it's exercise or maybe it's, you know, it's a craft or it's a hobby or like you said, giving back to your family or helping other people in addiction. So that's great advice. I would say to look for something else to replace that missing thing that made you feel good. You need to still feel good about yourself. So you need to involve yourself in a healthy activity.
Oh, absolutely. And there's so much guilt involved in addiction. And, you know, in terms of the addict, there's so much guilt. And you think, I'm never going to overcome all the things that I've done to my family. That's a huge piece.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Debbie, you can, you know, comment on this, because the fact of the matter is that if the alcoholic or addict puts together some time of sobriety, the family is so happy. And, you know, and if they get some recovery in them, whatever that looks like, you know, get
right.
some peace, you know, the family unit becomes very important to the addict and the alcoholic.
And that's why it's so important. For the, you know, I believe that it is a family disease. You know, everybody in the dance involved with the addict or alcoholic is also sick, you know, and needs to have their own program and work on their own self. But one of the things that I stress to clients is when they're dealing with an addict, is to not shame them, because addicts and alcoholics, you know, have such a deep root of shame.
Mm-hmm.
And so to continue to try to shame them in what they're doing, drives them deeper into the disease, because it's a cycle. You know, they
mm-hmm.
feel shame and guilt, so they use more, and then they feel guilt because they used, and it's a shame, so then they use more. When the person is trying their best, you know, getting in help and getting in recovery, it's so important to be supportive and applaud them and let them know that you're so proud of them and you know, that you're there, you know, as a support system. And also, I think one of the things that's so important when the family do be in recovery, and that I teach the family to take their hands off the addict's recovery program.
Oh, yeah.
you know, as codependents, we love to control and fix and police, you know, the addict. And so focus on yourself, you know, focus on your program and your, you know, your Al-Anon or your ACOA or whatever it is that you're working on in your 12 step or your recovery. And that's about you, and let them work on their recovery with their sponsor and their meetings, and to take your hands off of, because that's another thing that addicts hate, and it does make them feel more shameful, is if people in the family are trying to control and police their recovery.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Great, great points. It's been an amazing ride for my family, and the daughter that I had so much trouble being a mother to is just the greatest gift in my life. And I just will never, a drink just never will come in to mind, because I just don't want to ruin that relationship. And I know where I go. I get very selfish, and it's just not worth it to me.
It sounds like, you know, it's what most addicts finally get to that point where you have to have more pain than pleasure. The pain of the addiction has to rise above the pleasure that it was giving you. And until that happens, if the pleasure is still higher and the pain is, you know, it's painful, you're getting, you know, a lot of addicts will get arrested, love, all these things happen, but that high is just so, so high. And they'll never stop until, what, like your story, it's the pain became, you know, the consequences, everything was too much, and you right. keep that pain in your head and remember it. And that's what keeps you from using again.
Absolutely. And, you know, and as I said, one of the common things is that the alcohol and the drugs stopped working. And then that's when I really started to feel the pain, because that was the only coping skill I had. And so I've been using since I was 8 years old in some form or another. And I started with food. And, you know, by the time I was 12, I was a full blown addict. And all these bubbles are coming up. On
yeah, those are people. Those are people giving you alkaline.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. So when I got sober at 33 years old, I had no coping skills. And quite frankly, I had no life skills, because I had always been around people who used. Those were my friends, and that's often what happens. So, you know, I get sober, and now there's a lot of work to be done. And I learned a lot of life skills in 12 steps with my sponsor, just how to be in this world. And it's a huge road, but it is so worth it. All I ever wanted to be was happy. And I thought happiness was in a bottle. I was wrong. And it's funny, because normal people, you know, non-alcoholics, I call them, I'm normal now, but sort of, but people who don't use just go about their life, and they don't understand how hard it is for the alcoholic. It sounds so silly that I had no life skills, but that's the truth. And so I had stopped showering at the end of my use. So every shower I took, my sponsor said to me, "Good for you," you know? And so I get accolades like, you know, "You're clean today." And that's huge, you know, for somebody who's stopped caring about themselves.
And I love the point that you brought out about life skills, and I call them learning, you know, that don't have any coping skills. You know, one of the reasons people dive into addiction is they just can't cope with life. They maybe can't cope with the pain of their childhood or past, and they haven't known how to process through those emotions and those feelings and deal with life. And so because of not having life skills or coping skills, they escape in the alcohol or the drugs in order to not feel, because they don't know how to process. They don't know, they don't have coping skills and know what to do with that. So then, as you said, when you stopped using, that's why recovery and a program and sponsor and support is so important, and coaches like us to help people have instead strategies. You know, this is what I used to do when I couldn't cope, when a crisis came up. Now I need new strategies. I need to know how to handle this in a way without using alcohol and drugs in order to do this. And, you know, I believe, too, that, you know, all addicts are codependents, too. You know, they have codependent. You never see an alcoholic or an addict who has healthy relationships.
Right.
Right. And a lot of I've had a lot of clients who've been in recovery of their alcohol and addiction, and then they start working on their codependency issues,
right?
You know, the relationship issues. They say, you know, I've been sober, but I'm still having trouble with my relationships. I don't know how to have a healthy relationship, you know, with my family members or my significant other, and I need to work on this. Because even though I'm not using, I'm wanting to control, or I'm easily controlled, and I'm not able to cope with crisis in relationships. And also, a lot of times when people don't work on that part of their recovery, sometimes getting into a relationship and the dysfunction of that will cause them to use again and relapse.
Absolutely.
That's why it's so important, I feel, in recovery, that first year, don't get into a relationship if you're not in one. You know, if you're not married, or just try to work on yourself for about a year, and you know, don't worry, because it's easy to get your eyes on that other person and take your eyes off your own recovery.
Absolutely.
So we have a comment here from Kenny. Kenny says he's always had an addictive personality, plus not having coping skills, and those things accelerated his disease. So the whole, like you mentioned, Ginger, about being 8 years old and first using food and then switching to another addiction. So, you know, just curious, I mean, you know, this is a disease, but is there any way, going back in time from when you were a child, is there any way parents can better educate children? You know, is there, or is it just going to be a disease and there's nothing we can do to prevent addiction? But if you, speaking of your own child or going back in time, what do you wish your parents would have done, and, you know, to save you from this road that you went down?
You know, it's so interesting, this question, because, you know, I really believe I was born with this disease, because as far back as I can remember, I've been a sneak, and I was sneaky about it. And I remember, you know, my parents would have these dinner parties, and they would go in to the dining room, and I would go finish all the little drinks and relight all the little cigarette butts when I was 8 years old. And I remember the feeling of, like, this, the chase of it, getting away with it. And furthermore, I remember the feelings when the substances would go in my body, and I never got caught. And I always wondered, you know, I just was overlooked, or, you know, my parents were not terribly involved. And I think about, you know, my experience with my daughter now at, you know, 20 years old, she can't even lie to me. You know, she gets caught, you know, she did, you know, I feel like it's a different life from when I was a kid. You know, kids were told to get out of here and go play. You know, we're much more involved with our children now. And, but I would have loved, I mean, you know, in high school, I was very addicted to cocaine. And I got so thin. And my mother said to me, "Oh, honey, whatever you're doing, stick with it."
Oh,
you know, because her value system was being thin. And,
right.
You know, and I thought, okay, Mom, and I went in my bathroom to do another line of cocaine. So, you know, it's that's my story. And I think I also told my parents I was doing fine. I didn't want to get caught.
Right.
Right.
You know, in answer to your question too, Christine, about the children or the family, you know, I too believe that it's a gene that you're born with, whether you're predisposed to be an addict or not. You know, I have siblings. I had a sister who died of addiction. I have a brother who's been in recovery from crack and cocaine for several years now. And, you know, I looked at them and their life, and, you know, we grew up in the same home. You know, I was the oldest hero codependent rescuer of everybody. Mm. But I looked at them and so many times in life, and I thought, by the grace of God, there goes I, you know, that I could have followed right in their footsteps. But my brother, Christina, his story, when he shares his story in meetings and all, he says that his first addiction, he remembers and believes, was sugar, because I can remember him as a little boy. He was addicted to Cheerios. He would sit and eat a box by himself of Cheerios and pour spoons and spoons and spoons of sugar on that Cheerios. And my mother would let him, you know. And I think, you know, today we are a little more educated on sugar and foods, but he believes that that was his trigger of his first addiction, mm-hmm. was sugar and, you know, the Cheerios. He says his first thing he was addicted to was Cheerios and sugar. But wow. He also shares the story about when my parents, my father was an alcoholic, and when my parents would have parties, he tells, and I don't remember seeing him do this, but he says he did the same thing. He would go around, you know, when people leave a little bit in their drinks, he would go around and finish everybody's drinks at the party when he was like 7, 8 years old.
Yeah.
And loved how it made him feel. And I'm thinking, that is so young. But, you know, I think he was already predisposed to be an addict, you know, to become an addict. So,
right.
You know, it's a baffling disease, and it, you yeah. know, genetic. And
you can't figure it out
very young. And it can start also with food.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And, well, you know, I grew up in New York City, so there was a fair amount of independence. And I always thank my older siblings for paving the way for my parents to ignore me, you know, and because you guys, as first children, you know, you got all the attention. And my mother always says, by the time I got to parenting you, I was tired and blah. And, you know, and that's just the way it was. So I grew up in New York City. And I mean, I remember when I was, you know, 6, 7 years old, and I would steal chocolate from the store. So, you know, not only am I a sugar addict, I'm a thief. And, you know, and it just for the high of it, of get, you know, there's a high in stealing. There's a, you know, a high in the sugar. And so, you know, I just, that's the way I behaved. And though that, those are my life skills, you know, and when I wanted something, I took it. And that's, you know, that was permeated my entire life. I mean, I, you know, so.
It's really interesting what Debbie, you said about your brother and what Ginger's saying about herself. So say as a parent, you notice as you do have a child, you know, a young child who's, you know, shoving, you know, all the sugar, always wants sugar, maybe lies or sneaks. I'm wondering, and I don't know what the answer would be, but what does a parent do if they see a young, can we somehow, you know, catch this, educate parents maybe of these signs of, an, you know, the addiction gene or the personality, and help them at that level as a young, being really young before it escalates into the teen years where they start experimenting. I mean, I wonder if that's even possible.
You know, Christine, I had not long ago, I had a mother bring a daughter to me who was severely obese, and she was 15, 16 years old. And she actually brought her to me for my weight loss program that I coach. And when I spoke with her by herself, the young girl, she was binge eating and hiding food in her closet. And she started sharing, you know, I said to her, nothing you share with me, am I going to share with your parents? This is between you and I. But she was sharing with me the pain that she was in because of her parents' divorce and feeling like she didn't fit anywhere. And she started sharing her emotions and her feelings with me and how she was sneaking this food in her closet with her babysitting money, and how her parents were constantly putting her on diets and calling her fat and trying to buy healthy foods for her. And the parents were like ignorant. They had no clue that this girl had these deep emotional problems that she needed, you know, therapy, needed help with, that her weight, her answer was not that she needed a weight loss program. Yeah, she needed to learn, but the girl was already binging for her emotions and her feelings, and the parents could not see this. They were blinded to that. Mm. So I think, you know, parents need to be more educated and looking, like, you know, if I have a child who is constantly using food, like food. And a lot of times parents, as you said, Ginger, too, from small, will reward children with food, you know, for good. You get a prize. You get to go to McDonald's. You get to go get candy if you do good.
Yeah.
So people grow up relating, and I hear this a lot from my emotional eaters, that they were always rewarded. If they did good, they got food. If they felt sad or in the house, you know, they ate because they felt sad. So they related. There was no really mindful eating or mind-body connection. You know, the food was a reward of either happy or sad or whatever. It was a way to deal with emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of people who do that.
Absolutely.
A lot of people who use food emotionally.
And then that can escalate. Sometimes just stops with food, but then it escalates. I mean, I think addiction all boils down to the pain. You're trying to do something to soothe the pain that you have, something to get rid of it, you know, that feeling or whatever you have, you know, whether it's emotional. And then it makes it more complicated because you have these certain personalities of people who are going to get addicted to cigarettes, to anything, cigarettes, alcohol, drugs. I mean, I have four kids. My ex-husband was a smoker. I was a smoker. He still smokes. Out of the four, only one unfortunately, is addicted to cigarettes. But three of them, you know, were the kind who could, you know, take one and never have it again. And thank God they don't smoke. So it's interesting how, like you're saying, you know, one hand you're born with it, but then on the other hand, you have all these life circumstances of feelings and environment stuff that comes in. So I guess it's this matter of, like Debbie said, identifying it. And if you see your child is having, you know, really opening your eyes as a parent to get them help as early as possible, if you see some predisposition toward addiction, so they don't go down this road of hell.
And then we have today too, which is a whole nother topic, where obesity is in children and adolescents is 500% increase in the last 10 years. And a lot of that has to do with our internet and games and things that kids are just not active today. And a lot of our foods, what's in our foods today. So, it, you know, there is a lot of obesity with kids today,
right,
more so than it ever was. So, but listen, we're getting ready. We need to wind down our program. I have another appointment. And Ginger, it's been awesome having you on. Tell us a little bit in closing about your life coaching.
Oh, absolutely.
And
sure.
So people, in case people want to seek you out and how they can get in touch with
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. So it's gingerbcoaching.com. And you can go to my website. And I work with, mostly I love to work with people in recovery who get some, you know, some recovery and then working to, you know, create a joyous life. I do a lot of, most of my work is inner work. So we look at the blocks,
awesome,
limiting beliefs, assumptions, certain things that are holding you back from getting what you want. So that really is a lot of what I do. I love working with people who are struggling to get sober. And I have a 90-day program that I help people get sober. And I've got a lot of things in the pipeline that I'm working on. So I don't want to bore you with that. But I welcome anybody's conversation. You know, if they want to call me, you know, I don't charge for phone calls to just get to know me. So, so go to my website and all the info is there. This has been awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much
for providing this insight. And I think you're the perfect person. You know, if you're watching this and you're right now, you know, and addicted and you're caught in, you know, a life of hell of addiction, reaching out to someone like Ginger, who's been there, she knows exactly what you're going through. She's, you know, more than anything, I think that's really important for addicts to go to somebody who's been there, who knows it, who's, you can relate to more than, you know, somebody who doesn't have that life experience. So the website is gingerbcoaching.com. Is that correct?
Right. The letter B, because Berkelhammer is too hard.
Right. So. gingerbcoaching.com. Thank you so much, Ginger. It's been wonderful. Thank you, Kathy. And thank everybody. Thank you, Kenny, and everybody else who was on today. And have a wonderful weekend. Take
care.
Thank
you. You too.
Bye, Ginger. God bless.
Bye.